Hello and welcome to Volume 81 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss a potential problem for forest owners in the new Clean Water Act. We'll talk about how to make effective timber sales and whether it's still a good idea to plant trees. We'll also visit with someone who finds something useful, if not beautiful, in clear cuts. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. If you ask anyone on the street about their attitudes toward clear cuts, you'll probably get a negative reaction. Clear cuts are bad, right? Not so fast, says Tony Kenton, who's a lifelong outdoorsman. Hello, Tony.
Hello. Good morning.
What do you think are the primary obstacles to overcome when the words clear cut are mentioned?
Well, obviously aesthetics, right up front. A clear cut's not a very pretty thing to look at, and we've been accustomed to a big, pretty stand of trees, and just the idea of they're going to be gone is we tend to recoil from that. And that's justifiable, you know, because those trees are gone, and they're not going to be back, at least in my lifetime, at my age. And that's probably the primary thing, and the fear of, from a wildlife standpoint, I've heard people say, well, you know, this place will never be the same. It's the deer will be gone or whatever. And all those fears they're viable, but they're unfounded pretty much.
What's been your own experiences with these clear cuts as they relate to wildlife populations?
Well, it's been positive. Obviously, the aesthetic, particularly when you go back in right after a cutover, but if you just give it some time, and that time is not very long, particularly with deer and turkeys, which are two primary, primary big game in the southeast, and you'll find use in those cutovers almost immediately. So it has, my experience has been positive, both in leased lands that I've used in the past and on my own property that I've owned now for 20 years. It has been positive from a wildlife standpoint.
What are some of those positives with respect to particularly the white-tailed deer?
Food is probably the first thing I would say, because as all forest owners know, sunlight hits the ground when those cutovers are done, and it's just a banquet of food supplies, natural foods that come in there right after a cutover, and will be there until the replanted, reseeded section grows back and cuts out that sunlight, and even later on, and after thinning, that can be enhanced as well. But I'm thinking primarily of the initial stages, the cutover. But a food supply is almost immediate, and within a very short time, with these super pines, if you go back with those, 2 years, 3 years maximum, is some incredible bedding cover. And they're just, that's the beauty in the cutover.
All right. Well, thank you, Tony. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
I know the economy is in bad shape, and probably the last thing you want to do is spend money on planting trees when it'll be more than a decade before you'll see any return. Since fewer people are planting trees now, we thought we'd ask Derek Daugherty, a forestry consultant, why anyone would plant trees now. Hello, Derek.
Hey, good morning, Hayes.
Derek, these are tough times. The timber market's depressed. Is now really the time to be establishing pine plantations?
Hayes, these are tough times, but I believe now is actually an excellent time, and maybe one of the best times in a long time, to be planting pines for multiple reasons. Some would be the favorable supply and demand trends that we project forward, also the improved silvicultural technologies that are now available, and even the emerging markets that are coming available.
You've mentioned supply and demand as a favorable trend. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, Hayes, if we think back to simple market supply and demand graphs that we might have studied back in our college microeconomic days, we know that both decreased supply and also increased demand, you know, lead to higher equilibrium market prices. Pine plantations of this coming season and coming planting class really show promise to be in demand. If we look back to the 1980s, the late 80s, we planted 2 million to 2.5 million acres in planted pines every year. In the 90s, still 1.5 million to 2 million acres. And currently, we are down to planting just nearly over 1 million acres per year. So in comparison, the coming supply that we're producing now is minimal. But at the same time, on the demand side, population is expected to grow from about 6 billion in the world now to about 9 billion or 9 billion over the next 40 years. So thinking about the demand and market prices for the plantations I'm putting in the ground today, I feel really good with this increasing global and domestic demand and decreased domestic supply.
You've mentioned silvicultural technologies that are a plus. Why don't you explain that, especially in that would might justify planting trees?
Yeah, Hayes, in this kind of harder economic times, we're really blessed to have some really new, exciting options to put plantations in place. The real exciting part is kind of the convergence of the new genetic options, like the mass control pollinated seedlings we have available from Arborgen, or the varietal seedlings that are available from producers like Cell4. And we combine that with a really kind of an improved understanding of water and nutrient management for these new trees. Both of these combined take us to a new level of value potential.
The third thing mentions emerging markets as a reason for establishing pine trees. The trouble that some people have is how to plan for these emerging markets that really haven't been defined or established yet. How do you establish a plantation for a market that isn't even there yet?
It's a good question, Hayes. It's hard to plan for something that doesn't exist. But what we do know is that markets are emerging. A lot of work is going on there. And we can do a couple things in the field and then also outside of the field. In the field, we can simply move to what I call crown management, or maintaining a focus on keeping our trees healthy, keeping that photosynthetic factory or that portion of the tree that supports live needles in a really healthy, vigorous condition, planting moderate numbers of trees per acre and thinning when we should. And this allows us to keep our stands healthy and adapt when new options become available. Another thing we can do is just continue to keep our focus on traits that maximize value, straightness, limb size, growing the right number of rings per inch, those type of things. And then out of the woods, we really need to be diligent about keeping our focus on legislation right now. We can do that by supporting groups like the Alabama Forest Landowners Association and also on a national level, our Forest Landowners Association in Atlanta, Georgia, because these groups, they lobby for us at the state and the national levels, respectively, every day to make sure that these new markets develop favorably for us as growers.
All right. Thank you, Derek. Many people have easements on their property, whether for roads or utility lines or gas lines. One thing they have a lot of in Texas is oil and gas pipelines and attorneys. So we've combined the two with Amy Hess, a Texas attorney who's familiar with negotiating these type of easements. Welcome, Amy.
Welcome, Hayes. Thank you, Hayes.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the issues that folks who have never dealt with these easements are not considering but should consider when they're negotiating a pipeline or utility easement?
Well, Hayes, there are a number of them, but I've picked my top four that I see over my 35 years of practice people generally are not aware of. The first one is, it's important to take the long view when you are negotiating a pipeline or utility easement. Don't be seduced by the upfront payment for damages, no matter how much you might need that money, especially in these frugal times. That easement is going to be there for a long time, maybe forever, and so it can have major impacts on your use of that land. So it's important to take the long view when you're looking at an easement or right-of-way negotiation. Secondly, I have clients call who are upset because something bad has happened in connection with the easement, and it violates a promise the landmen made them that was verbal. Now, landmen, and they're called landmen, whether they're men or women, are always nice. And I hear my clients say, but they were so nice. Well, what they don't realize is it's their job to be nice. They wouldn't be landmen if they weren't nice. But they're not there to look out for your land. They're there to get you signed up as quickly as possible and with as little cost to the pipeline company or utility company as possible. It is not their job to look out for your land. That is your job. The third thing is, most of us, I think, know that if something's not in writing, it's not enforceable, with a few limited exceptions. What folks don't generally realize, however, is that sometimes something in writing, but if something's in writing but not in the main agreement, it may not be enforceable. There are a number of court decisions in Texas that say if there is an ancillary writing, such as a letter from the landman that contradicts the right-of-way or easement agreement, it may not be enforceable. And so people need to be aware of that. And then finally, one of the things that I try to get across to clients is the most important things, the most important terms in an easement or right-of-way agreement have nothing to do with the money you're paid. They have to do with a myriad of other things. In fact, I've listed quite a number of them on my website that have nothing to do with money but are just as important to your land. So I would say those are probably the top four things I hope people keep in mind.
Just briefly, should landowners use attorneys in negotiating these items?
Well, let me say first, I'm not the kind of person that thinks you need an attorney for every single thing you do. There are a lot of legal issues that people can handle themselves. But I think in terms of right-of-way or easement negotiation, an attorney's input can be really critical. And there are three reasons for that. One is many of the words in an easement or a right-of-way agreement seem to be ordinary words used in an everyday sense. However, unless you're experienced in this area, you don't know that they're not being used in their everyday sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even more dangerous is you don't know what you don't know.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Amy. We appreciate that very much. Everybody's talking about wood bioenergy. Almost every forestry meeting you go to these days has at least some portion of the meeting devoted to that topic. And while everybody's talking about it, now someone is writing about it and has in fact developed a magazine devoted to wood bioenergy. We have his publisher, Rich Donnell, with us. Hello, Rich.
Good day.
What was the thought process involved in the creation of this new magazine called Wood Bioenergy?
Well, our company, Hatton Brown Publishers, is a longtime publisher of trade magazines in the forest products industry. We do Southern Logging Times and Timber Harvesting magazines and have a couple sawmill magazines and a plywood magazine. And this issue of wood bioenergy has been hitting all around us kind of in the last few years and really longer than that in various ways. But we kind of sat around and said, how can we really, take advantage of this and really focus on the coverage of this industry? And it was kind of like, well, let's start up a new magazine. And there were people here who looked at me like, I was crazy. But we went ahead and did it early this year and produced the first magazine that came out in May. And we'll do probably a second one later this year and maybe go up in frequency next year. And so it was really just a way to capture this emerging market that like you say, is the subject of about every meeting you go to these days.
Mm-hmm. What has your response been for, I think, first issue's out, and what do you think the future holds for the magazine?
Yeah, the first issue, I think, has been a big hit. We've been to a few trade shows since it came out in May, and the response, including going overseas to a trade show in Germany, a big forestry show, and the response has been great. It's a national magazine. The first issue happens to feature two stories based in Alabama, one on the Dixie Pellets pellet mill in Selma, Alabama, and then there's a story on Ezel Castleberry's logging job as he has switched his operation kind of to a biomass focus. And really our goal was to focus on sort of the three main segments of the wood-based energy industry, kind of looking at fuel pellets, power generation, as well as cellulosic ethanol, while really following closely the feedstock procurement strategies and the in-woods harvesting and sort of the plant production technologies for each. And I think the first issue hit on that. And right now we've built up a circulation of about 20,000 names just in the U.S. And so far I think it's been good. And like I say, we're going to come out again with a winter issue in November, and we're currently discussing possibly going up to four times next year as this whole sort of new industry kind of shakes out a little bit and continues to define itself.
All right. We'll look forward to reading about that. Rich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Forestry is a topic that's little understood by most people, and that's because foresters don't do a good job of communicating what they know. But that's changing in the town of York on the Alabama-Mississippi line. Mark Bedsole is a consulting forester who's pioneered a new radio show on forestry originating from that timber-rich part of the state. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Hayes.
Where did your interest come from in educating the public on this topic?
Well, Hayes, my interest was fueled, I guess, from my previous employer, Georgia Pacific. They made a strong commitment to obtain their SFI label, and I was the SFI contact for the region I worked in with Georgia Pacific as long as being a procurement forester. But part of my job description required me to, as the SFI contact, required me to spend X number of hours each year with the general public, helping build a better image of the forestry business in the eye of the general public as well as landowners. And what I had to do is I went around to different schools in the areas I worked in and talked to some classes at times when they may have been discussing forest or wood or something of that nature in their science class. And I found it to be truly alarming at the way some of the children viewed the forestry business. Negative image could have come from something that they saw on TV or possibly picked up from a parent maybe driving by a clear cut, like we talked about earlier, not always the most appealing thing to look at, but I'm not sure where they got it from, but I do know that most of what you hear in the mainstream media is negative when it comes to the forestry business.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to speak up on behalf of the forestry business since I'm trying to make a living at it. I consider myself young. I've got a long time left in this business, I hope. And I know it's hard enough to make a living at it without a negative image being portrayed in the public or in the mainstream media, so I'm just trying to provide a different alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think your radio program is called Forestry Views. What is your goal with that program?
Well, each week with Forestry Views, we want to take a different subject matter that's related to the forestry business and discuss it in general terms to help provide landowners as well as the public with honest, insightful, accurate, and timely information. And hopefully a guest will come on each week that happens to be fairly knowledgeable about the subject matter being discussed and provide the information in a scientific manner, and also hopefully it'll be somewhat entertaining as well.
How long is the program?
It's a 30-minute show. It's on Saturday mornings on, I think you mentioned earlier, 104.9 York out of York, Alabama, and also I'm archiving each of these shows and putting it on our website for those listeners that may be interested that are out of the listening area of 104.9.
What's your plan for growing the coverage into other areas of Alabama?
Well, I'm currently working on that now. Hopefully, we can get some other markets, not only in Alabama, but possibly also in Mississippi, that would cover a larger listening area for those that may be out there that are interested. The more listeners that hear a message, hopefully the better understanding they will have just how important the forestry business is to our economy.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate you joining us.
Yes, sir.
The Clean Water Restoration Act sounds like something everybody should get behind, right? But oftentimes behind the title of a bill in Congress lies some aspects that spell big trouble. Don Parmenter is sounding the alarm over one aspect of this bill that could substantially change forestry in very tangible ways. Hello, Don.
Hi.
This bill is called the Clean Water Restoration Act. It's Senate Bill 787. What should foresters and other landowners be concerned about this bill?
Well, this is probably the largest, most expansive federal power grab in history. I know that's saying a lot, but I think it's becoming widely recognized at that. And yes, everybody wants clean water. But there are two things in this bill that go way over the top in terms of expanding federal jurisdiction. One, it would change the term navigable in the existing Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1972 and substitute waters of the United States, which would include wetlands, streams, prairie potholes, mud flats, sand flats, ponds, meadows, and sloughs.
Excuse me, that's a term that defines the jurisdiction and the whole operation of this act, so it's an important term, right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
and secondly, it adds new language to the 72 Act that it would also cover activities affecting waters of the U.S. Now, obviously, forestry is one of those, but it's hard to think of any significant human activity that wouldn't affect water. So this thing is really a wolf in sheep's clothing.
What do you think the motivation is behind changing this definition?
Well, you know, it's hard to pin it down. I think two things. One is clear, and that is the authors of the bill, and primarily the chairman of the Transportation Committee, Mr. Oberstar from Minnesota. And by the way, the Transportation Committee, because of the term navigable, has sole jurisdiction of this bill. It doesn't go before the Ag Committee. It doesn't go before Forestry Committees. It doesn't go before Natural Resources Committee. Mm. Solely the jurisdiction of the Transportation. But one of the things they want to do is overturn two U.S. Supreme Court decisions. One is the Swank decision out of Illinois in 2001, and also the Rapanos decision in Michigan in 2006, both of which ruled that the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency were already exceeding their authority under the Federal Clean Water Act of 1972. The second motivation is really not something that's getting a lot of attention, and that's the desire of national environmental groups to impose national land use control through the Clean Water Act and provide new jurisdiction, new authority to the federal government to control non-point sources of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two motivations.
Do you see any solutions that might be better than the way this act is drafted?
Well, you know, I don't think this bill is really about clean water at all. I think it's about governance. And it really comes down in large part to what kind of government we want. And, yes, I think there are solutions, but they're local. You know, the way you manage forestry and agriculture and public land use in Alabama is different than they do it in the high desert country of Idaho. So I think these things have to be tailored to the landscapes and the watersheds in the particular parts of the country, and they have to have broad support by the people most affected at the local level. And there are success stories. I'm sure you have them in the South. We have them here in the Midwest. They exist out west, you know, through joint powers agreement among local units of government, especially counties. And, yeah, there are local and state and regional solutions that would be better, cheaper, and faster. And they would give us water quality objectives without the negative economic and social and cultural impact that a bill like this would create.
All right. Thank you, Don, for that perspective on the Clean Water Restoration Act. Well, something that everybody can get behind is healthy forests. And much like doctors get together and study ways to keep the body healthy, tree doctors get together and study how to keep forests healthy. These groups that they form are called co-ops, and we've invited Dr. Lori Eckert, who is a tree doctor, to tell us about these co-ops and one that she's a part of. Welcome, Lori.
Hello.
Why do we need a forest health cooperative?
Well, I guess two reasons. On a daily basis, we get many, many calls from industry, from private landowners, from the military that has to manage, even from the U.S. Forest Service, about emerging forest health issues and what they can do about them. And the research has to be done to be able to figure out some of those things. And with the funding dollars from the Forest Service and from the military and from the state and from the federal government dropping, there just is no money to do a lot of this research. And we were approached by industry and other groups about forming this co-op so that we could work on projects that are pertinent here to the Southeast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the outcomes that you expect from this study?
Well, we hope to be able to develop management recommendations and strategies that will help land managers and industry mitigate effects of insects and disease. Currently, most of our research is based on pine decline, which is what the members of the co-op decided is the most important thing right now.
You said pine decline?
Pine decline.
Mm-hmm.
That affects millions of acres across the Southeast from Texas to Georgia, all the way up to South Carolina, and looking at how to manage the forest to help mitigate the effects of pine decline, the insect vectors that bring in the pathogen that are related to pine decline, and even aspects of how to managing other things in the stand, such as cotton grass, affect pine decline or anosem root rot or other southern pine beetle or other insects and diseases in the state.
If someone's interested in helping out with this research effort or learning more about it, how would they get some more information?
Well, we gave you a website link for the site. They can go and get much information about the co-op. They do accept tax-deductible donations to the university to help with the research, or you become a member, you have you're able to access the research information as soon as it comes out. We have many, many resources about insect disease and management on the website, as well as people to contact. We have an invasive species person, a pathogen person, and an entomological person as part of the co-op.
Okay. Thank you, Lori. Appreciate that. With housing starts down, many people are waiting to sell saw timber while pulpwood markets are providing most of the sales opportunities. It's probably a good time to review the most effective ways to sell timber now so that you'll be prepared for the future. Mike Dunn can help us with that. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Hayes.
What's the most important consideration for a landowner when it comes time to sell his timber?
Well, I still think the most important thing at timber sales time is the timber sale contract. As the speaker said earlier, when it comes to negotiating these things, it's very important that you, the landowner, get exactly what you want done on your land, because things that happen today can have a long-lasting influence. So getting that written down, getting that put the way that you want it, getting what you want out of a harvest operation, and getting all that into a timber sale contract is extremely important. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, I think the most important way to do that is to hire a consulting forester. You take me, for example. I'm a PhD forest economist. I've been in the forestry business for almost 20 years now. I have timberland, and I don't handle my own timber sales. I hire and maintain a consulting forester to do my work for me. And the reason is because these guys know the local markets, the local areas. They know what's going on in the region where they're working. They have the key contacts when it comes to the timber sale contract time. They know how to set these things up, and they know how to watch and monitor these things to make sure that your wishes are kept in order. And they're going to help you after the fact by going out and checking the harvest and making sure that it follows your guidelines and your specifics according to your contract. Mm-hmm. So those two things are extremely important, I believe.
From the landowner's perspective, and with the recent economic downturn, have the rules changed when it comes to marketing your timber?
Well, you know, it's so tough out there now, and so many people are just trying to hang on. You know, so many businesses that depend on a good, flourishing forest products market are struggling now and are going to continue to struggle for a while. And with all that, if there's a great incentive to cut corners and cut costs wherever possible. So right now it's more important than ever that you protect yourself and protect your land, protect your family's investments by doing these same things that you've done and being even more diligent about it. You know, get a consulting forester, have that consulting forester sit down with your family and discuss what you want out of a timber sale. Make sure you have a very good timber sale contract, and make sure you have that forester enforce that contract.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mike. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Tony Kenton, Derek Daugherty, Amy Hess, and Rich Donnell. We also appreciate the contributions of Mark Bedsoe, Don Parmenter, Lori Eckert, and Mike Dunn. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.